Okay, thank you. Welcome back. Just to mix it up before we hear from Ms. McLean and Mr. Roach, I want to throw in some comments from some persons on the chat and the WhatsApp, and then I'll let both of you have a good go at it before we go back to the lines. This one says, "All I want to do is not have to provide results of a blood test to open a simple account." This next one says, "I don't get the fascination with having a national commercial bank. If the argument is that profits will redound to the benefit of the country, then it could be said about any other business. Why doesn't the government get involved in vehicle sales? The profit from that would redound to the benefit of the country. Or why not establish a construction company? The fact is that we did have a national bank and it was not as profitable as when it was sold to private interests. Governments in these parts don't run things very well." I'll give you two more. This one says, "Good morning. I do believe it took over an hour to open a bank account on Friday. I provided everything that they required, including a job letter showing that I worked in government for nearly 40 years. I understand that recently in Jamaica, they have made it easier to open an account. Why is doing business or banking in Barbados so hard? My son told me he opened a bank in the UK with a student ID." This next one goes, "Good morning, sir. What Mr. Roach just mentioned about opening an account in order to have a check change, well, I've been told last month in the bank here in Philadelphia, as I was depositing his rent payments into his account, I was told as far as from December, I would not be able to make that deposit unless I have an account with the bank. That is going to be the bank's rules." So I put those four comments to both of you, and I go to Mr. Roach now to start to get some response.
But look, I think that in my view, many people are confusing the purpose of state-owned entities versus the purpose of private entities. I am not concerned with the whole competition situation where Barbados and the private sector is concerned. My concern is that Barbados of itself, and I want to make this clear, is that Barbados of itself needs to be making money. It needs to be generating its own cash to do its own capital projects, etc. This is not something that is required of Coralyn or Ms. McLean or no, that's not us. We are not supposed to take our we are not going to take our own businesses and build these roads, et cetera. The state has to make that happen. So the state needs to have revenue generating entities for that purpose. Opening a construction for this is blowing the whole discussion out of proportion. I'm trying to narrow it down as best as I can, you see? And Mr. Beckford pretty much stated what I said. The revenue that is coming in through the state-owned entities, as he said, he could agree that some of those revenues can go towards capital projects. But that's what I'm saying. He's saying some, I'm saying all, because the state-owned entities are there for the state. So every penny is supposed to go to the upkeep of the state.
Ms. McLean.
Yeah, let me tackle some of what Mr. Roach just said, because the notion of government owning a bank so that it can make profits, which in turn can be used to address national problems and, you know, social whatever else, security better to pay police or whatever. To me, that's not a logical approach to it. A commercial bank that is profitable will pay taxes, as with any other company and so on. So I think basically, what you're saying is that you want, and of course, if the commercial bank and any other financial institution that is very liquid can find ways of getting that money into the economy to generate activity, which in turn would pay taxes, you get the same kind of results. So I don't know that there's necessary. I think there's a psychological, perhaps, a national thing about owning a bank. And I recall when the Barbados National Bank was sold, the interesting thing, it happened at a time where just before that, I was involved in a consulting assignment with Professor Andrew Downs. I don't think you mind my calling his name, where we worked with the bank to do a number of things.
Oh,
Now,
it's hard.
that would have been sold to generate certain foreign exchange and so on, but I don't want to get into a lot of that. But there's no automatic major benefit from ownership. Now, I want to introduce another issue,└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└����������������������������������������������������������������������������������������������������������������������������������������������������������������������������������������������└������������������└².└            └└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└ which has to be addressed, whether it's a commercial bank owned in part by government and owned by locals.
I don't want to cut you in here, Strike, but I don't want to miss this major point. When people talk about a national bank, I always thought the main purpose of doing that is to help drive policy and so on by making the bank do certain things to make the others more competitive. No, that I've not heard that part mentioned just now.
I don't know that and you would have to show me where that has been. I mean, I think that in what we had was a development bank, where the focus was really on making sure that commercial sectors, whether it be agriculture, manufacturing, etc., would have been financed. And those things were done with perhaps certain kind of concessionary financing in a way that, even though they were concessionary, should still have allowed the development bank to thrive and prosper. So the issue, therefore, is if you're seeking to achieve the national objectives, one of them being the fostering or the facilitating of economic development, what is the best mechanism to do so? And I think that is where we had the national bank. Now, the problem that came, and I haven't got any empirical evidence, so I'm talking about, the kind of anecdotal things you heard, that people did not want to pay back because it was quote-unquote local, government money. In some instances, there may be issues where projects that did not necessarily merit financing might have been financed and so on. But that is, research can tell you what were the causes for the failure or the decision to end a development bank. So that is one of the things. But a national bank, a national commercial bank, from the way I see it and the way people have, I understand people have been talking about it, is a situation where you're saying, look, we want to give the nationals of the country the opportunity to invest in this company called a national bank. And that was something that happened. There were the customers. Now, the difference, of course, with a branch of an international bank or a foreign-owned or regionally, externally-owned, let me put it that way, bank, is that the profit are by and large, the net profits being after taxes have been paid to government, etc., the net profits are repatriated. And I think that is one of the big concerns. Now, if you have a bank that is solely owned by government, then all the profits, presuming that it is profitable, and I don't see why a locally owned bank can't be profitable if it is managed and so on properly. Those profits will stay with government to do all the things that Mr. Roach spoke about, or some of the things. If it is nationally owned and you have multiple shareholders in the form of citizens, they in turn then have some capital, they make returns on the investment, so their capital gains to them and so on, with the share values go up, etc. And they then have those resources to do other things. So I think we need to break out a number of these things. But the issue that I want to introduce is the whole issue of correspondent banking, which is going to be a challenge for whoever starts a bank and so on. And the reality is, in the age of the complaints that we've heard across the Caribbean, because at the end of the day, we're all small economies and our banking systems and services are small relative to other international banks, that there's a need when you're interfacing with the international environment, trying to do business internationally, whether as a hotel, an importer, an exporter, of goods and services, you need to interface with banks outside of Barbados. And in order to facilitate that, there needs to be an intermediary bank, which you call the correspondent bank, that is going to facilitate those transactions. I mentioned at the beginning the whole context in which regulations have evolved in the last, I would say, 25 years or so. And more recently, since the this whole issue of terrorism and most recently in the global financial crisis, which translated later to an economic crisis as well for the world, that correspondent banking and the rules governing those things became more difficult. So any financial institution has to look at that. And the question you ask is, how easy is it for a standalone bank in a small jurisdiction like Barbados How easy will it be to get that kind of facility if you decided to follow the suggestion, I think, of Mr. Beckford, I believe, who talked about a local bank, or even Mr. Roach in terms of a national bank. So the environment in which you look to set up a new standalone bank now is very different from what it was several years ago.
All right. Thank you very much. Yes, go quickly, Colleen. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Quickly, I'll respond. Thanks, Ms. McLean. Ms. McLean said that what I had commented was not logical in her view. But then coming on to the end of that segment of her response, she agreed that, yes, if you have a national bank and it is managed the correct way and so on, the revenue that is coming in from that bank, if it is profitable and so on, it can go towards doing things for the state. And that is really my point. You know, I don't have any argument with that. In terms of correspondent banking, I just want to use some common sense, okay? We had a national bank. I am speculating that we had some measure of correspondent banking when we had this bank. It is sold now, and we have 5 private entities in Barbados. They have to be dealing with correspondent banking. I can understand also there are necessary changes that were made throughout the years lately, but I am not prepared to accept that Barbados of itself re-establishing a national bank can't get correspondent banking. If we have 5 entities here that have correspondent banking, I believe that the country of itself, having its own national bank, should be able to get correspondent banking, just like private banks that are foreign to this nation.
All right, let's leave that there for now, and let's hear more from the public. Let's say good morning, and let's hear from you. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm, good morning.
The Development Bank and the Retail Bank, Ms. McLean got those things completely mixed up. I'm very sorry. I'm not even going to speak to what she had said. The gentleman who spoke about direct income for the government to do development campaigns is bang on the mark. It's bang on the mark. Believe it or not, Antigua owns half the gas stations, retail gas stations, and they did that for a reason, because they want direct income coming in. I mean, unfortunately for the Antiguan population, the ownership of the gas station is not used to fix the retail price to the public, which it should do. You know, Ms. McLean, although I wasn't going to speak more, but Ms. McLean speaks about moral suasion. The central bank can't force any bank, commercial bank in Barbados, and the commercial banks in Barbados have never really ever proven to be part of the development plan of any kind. They exploit Barbadians. So if it is that through the use of a national bank, the government could use that exploitation and use the funds, I don't care what happened in the past. We're moving forward now. We got better students now. We got better Barbadians now. We have more professional people. They can run a national bank better than anyone in the past. Well, they can run a lottery too. We should have a lottery as well too. There's absolutely nothing wrong with what that guy said. Barbadians are only being exploited for the sake of profit. But why is it that Barbadians cannot be exploited for the sake of development as well? These guys are not earning foreign exchange from Barbados. You go into a bank in any event. Let me speak about correspondence for a while. You go into a bank in Barbados. Let me go to one of the major... I got a check from a Canadian bank that had the same brand name as the bank here in Barbados. I went to that bank and said, "What money, please?" That was last year. They tell me I'll wait 30 days. I said, "Mike, you know how much noise they make?" I stand up on the middle floor and I raise hell. And eventually a manager came down and he called the bank in Canada and verified that the check was valid. That's all it took. And it was done, but it had the same brand name. And we can talk about correspondence. Man, these banks, even the Trinidadian banks in Barbados, but I suppose one Trinidadian bank, you can go down there and shop using your Barbadian account. But the own intermediary thing should not even be a consideration if you're dealing with brand name banks. But that's for the correspondence. I'm just saying, in agreement with the guy, the banks do not form any real part, any major part of the development plan, but yet they are so fundamental to the working of the economy. Things like a fractional reserve, they create money for the Barbadian retailers to use. That is what banks do at a very fundamental level. Like LIAT, you can't put certain things in the hands of private sector alone and expect you'll get development out of them. I don't understand why it's so difficult, but what that guy said is so difficult to understand. You need to have ways to use the exploitation of Barbadians to make it work in their interest. The private sector and their profit agenda, used to the argument used to be that makes things work better. But I'm very sorry. the public service got the same kind of staff with the same qualifications, got for the same UE, who would do the same things if properly placed in the right positions. We have a national insurance. They ever say, no, let me put the national insurance in private hands and let me take the government out of it. We know the government will do certain things, but all that is required is for, a directorship, a board that actually does work, not a national insurance board, but a board that actually does work outside of the purview of the government to make sure that that particular government-owned entity delivers the product at the level that is required. And not only that, but when the funds do come in, that they are directed to the areas that are required, that are needed, like the building of roads and bridges and that sort. It's direct input. Somebody said, oh, the banks pay tax. What can the tax them is pay? 2%? No, 5%. It used to be 20%. Now I think it's been dropped to 2.5% or 5%. That is nothing. That is a monkey argument. It is a monkey argument. And if this is the only reason to have a commercial bank that's owned by Barbados is to drive the retail end and the services that are being provided because the central bank can't do it through moral supervision, but that is reason enough. That is reason enough. But my point, that's backing up that last guy. But my point, though, what I would like to say is that there's no reason for the banks in Barbados to be forcing people to stop on the sidewalk to get inside the bank. Because the supermarkets don't do it no more. Retail shops don't do it anymore. But it's only the banks and the credit unions that think that it is necessary to keep people standing up. Oh, sorry, and the BlackRock Polyclinic. People standing up. And I would really like to know what is the reason for so doing.
All right,
because you got all that space on your side. Let people go inside. That's what I would like to speak about.
All right, let's get some response to that. Thank you, sir.
If I might, Corey, I'm not sure that the caller understood the point I was making. But let me just say that the difference between the notion of a development bank as a catalyst for development and a commercial bank takes deposits from the public and has to manage those in a way that allows for the return and so on. And if you're talking about financing business. A development bank will probably take greater risk than a commercial bank because a commercial bank basically has fiduciary responsibility, the person whose savings it is mobilizing and using. So I am not sure how he misunderstood what I said. And in terms of the objective of a commercial bank, you have to recognize that they by nature have to be less or more risk averse. Let me put it that way. And probably take less risk. And that is why we need to have different kinds of options. And there are perhaps ways in which government can stimulate the transfer of funds that are sitting, for want of a better word, idle in the commercial banks. And increasingly so, you will see having people move monies to credit unions, that the liquidity in credit unions have been rising proportionately, something I spoke about as a risk and how they can probably tackle it. And at some point, we can probably get into those discussions. But at the end of the day, a commercial bank is at the heart of it, a caretaker of people's finances. And the kind of decisions that are taken reflect that. And that is why government cannot mandate how, those funds are utilized heavily in any one direction. So if you're talking about a national bank, you have to ask yourself a national bank that is often what I call retail services, or if its focus is on providing developmental finance. So I don't want to belabor the point, but I think he missed the point that I was making. And so the nature of the two things pretty much shape the kind of focus and services that they offer.
Okay, Roger, well, go ahead.
If I could respond to that.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I understood what Auntie America was saying quite clearly. I don't think that he misunderstood Ms. McLean. He said exploit. Okay, so if there is a need to have commercial and development in the same building, make it happen. Our job is to facilitate the needs of the public, commercially, developmentally.
Let me respond very quickly as not as a director of a bank or a member of the board, a chair or whatever, of the president of a credit union, but as a saver and a borrower. If I take my money, and certainly as a person now who is at retirement age, if I have saved my money in the city of Bridgetown or one of the commercial banks, or a couple of them, from the time I was 12, 15 in the case of one of our commercial banks, and certainly from the formation of my credit union in 1983 till now, I do not expect that there can be any dictating to that institution, either one of them, how those monies are to be used in terms of investment, or where they should go. Because I hear you talk about exploiting. You cannot take the funds of citizens and dictate that they go in a specific direction as in the funds lodged in a commercial entity, such as a commercial bank. What you can say or what you can do policy-wise as a government is to say, look, we have recognized that over the past 25 years, for example, we have, and I think that's a reasonable number, we have seen a significant level of liquidity in the banking system, in our financial institutions, and therefore that liquidity is doing nothing for the development of this country. What we are going to create is, and I use an example, as in Trinidad, you have, I'm trying to remember the name of the institution, but let's say you have a development finance institution or a venture capital fund. A unit trust was what they had in Trinidad. And we're going to create or help to have created an entity like that, which is for venture capital, and say to Barbadians, rather than leaving your money in the bank, attracting soon perhaps no interest at all, we would recommend that you invest in this company, which then gives a pool of funds. And I'll use some numbers to be very specific. We have about, let's say, 150, I'll use 100 because it's easy to use, 100,000 employees, let's say, who may have the capacity to withdraw tomorrow from one of the financial institutions, whether it's a bank or a credit union, $1,000. So if 100,000 people withdrew $1,000 tomorrow and put it into a venture capital fund, immediately you have $100 million, which can be used to finance a manufacturing operation, a service operation, research and development for people looking to find ways to use the medicinal plants in Barbados, called whatever. But you cannot say to the commercial bank, you have to invest in that. But what you're saying to Barbadians, here is an opportunity for you to invest in some things that will create employment for the young graduates of our high school, the university, the Samuel Jackman Prescott Institute of Technology, the Barbados Community College, whatever. But you're saying to them, we're asking you to, we're making this possible, but you're actually risking money. Because when you invest like that, you're risking money. But the truth is, if it sits in the bank for the next 5 years, getting no interest, it actually is declining in value. But you cannot say to the commercial bank, you have to invest in that. Because if a customer believes that his or her money is at undue risk, then you may decide to, you take it from there. So my point is that what I think should happen is that individuals, because it can also be a private sector initiative, individuals supported by government or government championing a situation like that can say, how do we create mechanisms, or how do we support and regulate mechanisms that will allow us to encourage our citizens to see that beyond saving, they can invest. And you can start investing in amounts that you can put at risk without doing financial harm to yourself. And I think that that is important. But if we are talking about government dictating certain kinds of rules and regulations, they may prove to be counterproductive. And I certainly have been pushing the notion of venture capital funds with the credit union movement since back in 2004, for example, and something that I've been speaking about forever, as one of the ways of looking to address liquidity. And it is becoming, or it has become rather, more critical that we do that now that we are faced with the kind of challenges we have domestically because of international developments and certainly the current climate that prevails globally. So I think that that is one way we can look to address that. But I still would argue that we have to be careful about seeking to mandate certain actions which may cause customers of our financial institutions and members of our credit unions to get concerned about any rules that seek to dictate how their savings are managed or used in ways that can be harmful to them if overly risky enterprises or activities or, you know, initiatives are undertaken.
Can I respond?
Okay, now before you go, it's just 6 minutes afternoon. We've been joined by Donna Wellington. And it's, remember I told you just afternoon, we'd be able to bring the panel of bankers online to be able to answer lots of your questions. I have lots of questions mounting for them. So no further ado, I would like to introduce Ms. Donna Wellington. She's the managing director of the CIBC First Caribbean Bank and the six countries the bank operates in the OECS. Donna is also the president of the Barbados Bankers Association, which is an umbrella body for the five commercial banks who fiercely compete but come together to deal with matters that impact the banking industry as a whole. The banks are moving to transform the digital payment system in Barbados, including new functionalities such as real-time payments between all players and to encourage financial inclusion in the light of digital payment legislation and new technologies internationally, which we want to quickly embrace here in Barbados. So let me quickly embrace Ms. Donna Wellington and welcome her to the program. Good morning and welcome, ma'am.
Good morning.
So
happy to be here.
Happy to have you. Definitely happy to have you. So we brought in a number of resource persons and we've been discussing all the different elements of the bank and I've been making my records here so that as we bring in the panel of bankers at this time, you ladies can answer the questions that many of the resource persons and panelists and those on the line have been asking. We also have been joined just by Kim Stanton, and she is one of Scotiabank's key executives. She has been with the bank since 2003, during which her time and her career has led her to various senior positions in Scotiabank. Kim possesses a wealth of experience in information technology, risk management, business continuity, project management, and most recently, retail banking management. And retail banking has come up quite a bit, so we're happy to have you, Kim. She is presently the manager at the bank's flagship branch in Barbados, Broad Street, Bridgetown. Good morning and welcome, Kim Stanton.
Hi, good morning, Corey.
Hi, morning. Donna, let's start with you right after this break. We are coming back, but we'll talk to you about some of the things that have been raised and some questions I believe you and Kim really are and in position to give us an answer to. 8 minutes afternoon, this is Brass Tax Sunday in association with Williams Industries Incorporated.
You depend on BRC for genuine permaclad, color clad, and permaseam steel roofing products. But did you know you can depend on BRC for installation too? That's right. BRC has several experienced roofing teams to handle your roof installation professionally, using tested and proven fasteners and methods with satisfaction guaranteed. When it comes to roofing, there's no substitute for experience, and BRC's crews will give you a great job at a great price. Have your roof installed by the experts. BRC.
Thank you very much. If you're now joining us, you're listening to Brass Tax Sunday, and the topic is banking and you in the context of COVID-19, 2020, and even before that with the changes of factor, correspondent banking, etc. Lots of you have many concerns and many questions, so we put together a panel of bankers along with some resource persons to help you navigate and how best to engage the bank in the 21st century. So we have a power team now online who will help walk you through that. Donna and Kim, two of the main concerns that were raised thus far is the whole idea of service, the long waits, the move from people to technology, but still it being very difficult with people having a fear of technology and inability to use technology. And the second one being the difficulty in opening accounts and dealing with checks and so on. So let's start with you, Donna, in terms of speaking to the wider population on how to navigate banking in the 21st century, in your opinion.
Okay, well, thank you again very much for having us here. I want to start by talking about what banking is transforming into. And a lot of it has to do with the aspect of being, in many ways, self-service. Whilst people think that this is a bad thing, I think that those who are actually doing it recognize that there is a lot of power to be had when you indeed are able to do things in your time and in your way. This is what we are trying to support, embrace, and help people along the journey with. And I think that once people who can try, they will recognize that there's a lot of benefit in that. Self-service banking typically nowadays includes internet banking and mobile banking, even ATMs, and we're now embracing here in Barbados, bit by bit, smart ATMs that help us even with depositing checks and those sorts of things where they exist. I can tell you though that the journey is going to be one where we are moving away from those types of instruments, however, and moving towards more digital instruments. We recognize that there are some persons who just do not have this capability. It may be because of age, it may be because of lack of the technology. But I think that when we look at the absorption and certainly the amount of cell phone usage in Barbados, we can't really say it's really a fear of technology, because many people have embraced, old and young alike, have embraced technology. And so we want to be there to help persons who may just have fear, but it's nothing else but that, to embrace the technology. And actually, a lot of our banks have started to do this by even installing in each bank digital champions and that sort of functionality, so that when people come into the bank, that we can help you to figure out why you really actually don't need to be in the bank, but you can actually do a lot of those things on your own, in your own time, in your own space, and not have to deal with standing up in lines in the bank.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much for that. Let's see if we have any questions or comments from the resource persons, Mr. Roach, Ms. McLean, before we go to the telephone lines or to the chat.
Yes. Welcome, Ms. Wellington and Stanton.
Hello.
Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you.
Ms. Wellington, you are the spokesperson for the Bankers Association here.
I am.
So with respect to the menacing, if I may call it so, issue of cashing checks where the bank or some banks are requiring that the person who is cashing the check has to open an account. The account is already established at the bank, for example, Scotia. The client is there. That's their account. They paid me, for example, by check. I come into Scotia and they say to me, I have to open up an account. It happened to me personally before. And I am thinking that may be good business for them, because the more accounts they have, the better it is for them. But not providing the service that you signed up for is another thing. Forcing me to open up an account to cash one of your checks, I don't think is correct. How are you going to address that with the banks?
Well, let me first say, as you have said at the beginning, it's some banks and not all banks.
Right.
And I would prefer if one of the banks that actually you mentioned there, as seeing as Kim is on the line, that she speak to that specific issue in her specific bank. Because that's not something that all banks you can represent is a practice of all banks.
Fair enough, but you represent the banks, and I would like to.
But I've said to you that the majority of banks, that is not their position.
Yeah, but what are you going to do? What are you going to address? What are you going to say?
There are five banks, and as I mentioned even in the bio, we fiercely compete. And we also come together on matters that are along all industry lanes. But yes, where there are aspects where individual banks do individual things, yes, and we actually have a representative of that bank on the phone,
yes,
Yes. I would much prefer if that bank speak to that issue, because it's not an issue that represents all banks.
I have no problem
okay,
with
thank
that.
Thank you. All right. Okay, Mr. Roach, we're going to get an answer from that. We're going to go over to Kim Stanton and let her speak to that. And then we have Carol Jean-Marie on the line, and we're going to introduce her. So, Kim, let's go over to you to get some response.
Thank you, Corey, and thanks, Donna. I wanted to clarify one of the statements that was made earlier, and I do understand the frustration. I can appreciate the frustration that Colin has spoken to with cashing checks. One clarification, though, is that we do not insist that you have to open an account when you come to cash a check and you don't have an account with us. The ask of the bank is that you deposit the check at your respective financial institution, whether it be a credit union or another FI. So that was just one thing clear. I'm sorry that was your experience that you would have had at, I am assuming it was at that particular FI, I'm assuming it was Scotia. If it was, my apologies, but the approach is not to insist that you open an account. Now, if you do choose to open an account, we facilitate it. But the message is you deposit the check. If you do not have an account with Scotia, you deposit the check at your respective institution.
Can I respond to that?
Yeah, go ahead on this occasion. Go ahead.
Thank you very much, Ms. Stanton.
Yes, you're
I hear what you're saying, but the bank is there to provide a service. And whether or not I have another bank, I am saying that if the client that gave me this check, wrote this check for me, has the funds in the bank to cover the check, I do not see why I should have to deposit the check into my personal account for a clearance, nor should I have to open up an account at the present bank. Now, you're saying that the bank does not force it, but I couldn't get the check changed, Ms. Stanton. That's the whole point. And I'm not the only person that has experienced this. And this is something, if it has not been brought to your attention by members of the public and so on, personally, I'm sure that you probably have heard of it. And they say 100 Frenchmen cannot be wrong.
Corey, if I can say something about that matter of cash-in checks, and I just have a simple question or comment to make. And the question really and truly, if I write a check and give it to you and you present it, to whom are you offering the service? As far as I'm concerned, as the customer of the bank, you are offering a service to me in the form of checking the account, which is cashing that check, which is part of an account I hold with you. So I think that if that is seen, then you shouldn't be asked to open an account with my check. Because when I set up a checking account with the bank, my assumption is that they were offering me a full package in terms of depositing money in the checking account and issuing checks. And therefore, if the person to whom I issued the check was a 18-year-old who did not have an account and he or she turned up with a check, then it should be honored by the bank. So that for me is my response to any commercial bank who will say, take it somewhere else and deposit it, or open an account with me. I am doing business with you. You have offered me a service, and part of that service is to cash my check. And that's how I think it should work.
Okay, so let me give you, I think we should go back a little bit and step back as to why the bank made the decision. The decision was made primarily for compliance, know your customer, for compliance reasons, first and foremost. Secondly, the service we were able to provide our actual customers. Since making this decision, we've seen it improve. We've seen our service or via surveys significantly improve with the response, because we found that customers that didn't have or hold accounts with us and managing those customers along with the customers that were actual customers, paying customers, we weren't able to provide the high level of service that we promised. So secondly, the service that we're able to provide our actual customers has improved immensely since making this decision. In addition to that, thirdly, which I'm sure all can relate to, was primarily for the health and safety of our customers. Just to clarify, you know your customer, because I know earlier in listening to the program, there was some confusion or clarification needed with our regulatory requirements. So know your customer is where you have to know your client and guide, know your client guidelines in financial services. It requires that professionals make an effort to verify the identity, suitability, and the risk involved when we're maintaining the relationship. So first, in making this decision, we took into consideration the impact to customers. So while we would have said to customers, this is something that we're not offering, we took a big picture approach. We said to commercial customers, this is not a service we're going to be offering. So we've reached out to them. We've worked with them to ensure that any customer that they would have written a check previously on, assist them or educate them, support them in digitally making those deposits to customers. For those customers currently writing, and those are primarily retail customers that are writing checks to others, what we've started to do also, and I'm sure some can attest to it, we've reached out to them directly in helping them understand the alternative means of transferring cash or paying, sending cash to their recipients. So for someone writing a check currently, if they use the online banking and knowing the other person have an account at a financial institution, they can quickly sign on, send the funds to the customer same day, same time. And those are the added benefits that you have instead of writing a check to a customer or to a recipient who now has to come into the bank, stand in line. For some who have to take the bus, that's time saving that they've now gained if they use the alternate channels.
But I, you know,
if I could, Corey, I just want to quickly respond to Mr.
Point for both of you.
Because let me quickly respond, because you mentioned know your customer. I am writing the check, so you should know me. Now, with the technological initiatives that you spoke about, it suggests that there will be a decline in physical checks being presented. And to me, that again is an even stronger argument why the person holding that check perhaps should be able to cash it. Because if I can use the other options, I will certainly do that. I don't want to come and stand in line and wait an hour and a half, which is fairly standard for some places these days. But I would use those. So it really says to me that as you do those things, there is less reason why you should be saying to somebody, take it somewhere else or open an account, because you are working with your customer. That is the person who is doing the transfer of the funds to a third party. And therefore, those are some of the considerations that should be given to those individuals. Because once I can prove that I am Maxine McLean with my ID, and a check written to Maxine McLean from Corey Lane, you know Corey Lane, you have the check, and I can prove that is who I am, then you, unless it was some, and again, if it's over a certain sum and so on, there is that you can probably verify that check is valid. But to say to me, take it away, take it to another bank or credit union or whatever, but one of the things that is happening, and I can tell you that from talking to people, a number of people are walking around with cash that they shouldn't be walking around with, because they're concerned about the security of some of the online transactions and so on, or simply that they don't want to be bothered. They say, well, let me just get some cash and I take it out and hand it to the person, which is probably a regressive kind of situation.